Hey everybody, just wanted to give you a heads up that in today's episode we mentioned something about Oceano Dunes and the meeting being on July 13th. It is actually today, July 11th, so be aware of that as you listen to the section on Oceano Dunes. Hope you enjoyed the episode.
Welcome one, welcome all to the Snail Trail 4x4 podcast. If you like going off-roading in Toyotas, wrenching on Toyotas, camping in Toyotas, and maybe poking a little bit of fun at Toyotas, and of course, hearing about how awesome Koyo wheel bearings are, then this is the podcast for you. I am your host today, and sitting here on the other side of the lovely Snail Trail shop is the one, the only, Mr. JJ, Mr. Hydrojet. JJ the Hydrojet is what we're calling you from now on.
Oh, jeez. I'm getting Jimmy. So many nicknames. I don't know why. What's funny is that in the email you told me, or in the email you responded, I'm going to call you that next time. And I didn't. I thought you forgot. I was hoping you forgot.
I think it technically was before the last episode, and I totally did forget. And I remembered today while we were having lunch, and I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot to call you JJ.
Yeah. So funny backstory on that. I actually used to be called JJ for a little while.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, back in, it was like a short stint when I worked at a place. They found out my middle name, and then they started calling me JJ. And so, yeah, it was fun.
Nice. So, everybody out there can thank one of our listeners. I believe it was, it's not Evan. It was the other one, the other crazy guy that emails us about a random stuff and it's hilarious. Yeah, you can thank him. But he called,
Name's drawing a blank.
I know I'm terrible with names. I really am. But yeah, he came up with nicknames. He knows who he is. He came up with nicknames for Jimmy and I, and Jimmy was JJ and I was Tay Tay. And he promised that he would never use those in public ever. And I was like, oh, don't worry. I'll use them for you.
Yeah.
So, anyways, JJ, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Tay Tay. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing pretty well. I'm excited because, my wheel bearing has been squeaking on me for a while now. It's been about 4 to 6 months that it's been squeaking on me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I've just kind of been like, I'll get to it. And then after I did a day trip in and out to Buck Island on the Rubicon.
Okay. Yeah.
And at the end of the trip, it wasn't squeaking anymore. So.
That's
not
usually a good sign.
That's usually not. I'm like, it's a 2% chance that it's a good sign, 98% chance it's a really
bad
sign.
That's like when your rear diff stops leaking oil.
Exactly. Yeah. So, earlier today we pulled my rear axle, my driver's side rear axle, and sure enough, my bearing was in about 5-6 different pieces,
something like that. It was toasted. Yeah.
It was pretty funny. We took it up to a place just to have let them press off the old stuff and press on the new stuff. And I walked in the shop, right?
Yeah.
And he immediately, I was just like, hey, and I'm holding the axle here and I put it down on the counter and he kind of looks at it and goes, hey, how's it going? I said, pretty good. And he goes, hold on. Looks like you need a new bearing there, huh?
Yeah.
I was like, oh yeah.
It was that demolished. Like there was no question about it.
Oh yeah. Like the whole front ring part of it that holds all the bearings in the bearing.
Yeah.
Was completely off. And right. Free floating in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's like little clips that hold the roller bearings place, mm-hmm. kind of thing, and inside the container. And half of those are like sticking out.
Right.
I don't know if I was missing a bearing or not, but there was a lot of space in there. I was like, I don't know if there should be this much space inside a wheel bearing.
It was bad. And you know, something we might consider doing is actually draining your rear diff and taking all that oil out, because I'm sure you have some sort of metal in there.
I'm sure we do too. That's probably going to be on our to-do list too when we put it back together today. So, So if your wheel bearing ever stops squeaking on you, you probably have big problems and you should you should look into it.
Wise words from Tyler.
Dun, da, 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 the more you know. Today's podcast is brought to you proudly by all of our people of our Patreon. So you guys have been freaking awesome over there. I'm still amazed that, you know, people out there want to support us. It's really cool to see. you guys out there that just like listening to me and Jimmy talk about off-roading stuff. It's really awesome. So we're really excited to have you guys on board, and huge thank you for all the support you guys have. And our new subscriber this week is Carlos. So Carlos signed up for the monthly drawing. He's going to be automatically entered into the, where are we at, July now.
Yep.
The July drawing for a Tracker RGB rock light kit from Sidetracked Off-Road. So everybody that is on that tier or higher is automatically going to get entered, and we will make sure we do the drawing correctly.
Yeah.
So you guys all make it into the drawing this time. And then we ended up, I don't know if you guys heard or not, because we didn't announce it on the last podcast, but we ended up having two winners for the month of June because we messed up the drawing and forgot to include two people, which, sorry guys, but we redid it.
Yeah.
So there ended up being.
Yeah, we ended up taking the winner out and did a whole redrawing, so everybody was eligible, and had two winners. And I mean, that's the right thing to do.
Yep.
I mean, that, you know. That, or we could have just done a drawing for the last two, but that's not fun.
That's no fun. That's a 50-50 chance.
They would have liked that, though.
So I've been using my same Morphlate for like 5 years. It's like the same one that I just kind of swap out parts on and everything. And the guy, one of the two guys that we missed in the first drawing.
Yeah.
He's a decent buddy of mine, and I've gone wheeling with him before, and he said that if he doesn't win the Morphlate, he wants to, you know, if there's any like used ones that I have laying around, I was like, well, I guess technically I have one with the old manifold that I should really get rid of and move on.
Yeah.
But it's like my beta one that I've been using for 5 years. I kind of want to see how long it'll last before it just fails and stops working.
Sure.
But I ended up giving it to him for a really decent price because A, I felt bad about the drawing mishap, and B, he's a good buddy of mine. So, that was nice of you. Yeah, I'm a nice guy. You hear that, everybody? I am a nice guy, I promise.
So, what it sounds like is you just need to throw some pity at Tyler, and he'll end up giving you a cheap Morphlate.
I'm a sucker for that. I really am. But if it becomes too much, I end up disappearing for a while. We had the two winners from June. July is a really nice set of rock lights. I'm running them on the 4Runner, and I got to use them out on the Rubicon this last week since the last time I talked to you guys out there.
Which we'll get into in a little bit.
We'll get into that a little bit. And they worked awesome at nighttime. They were beautiful. So they helped me find all the reflectors on all the granite out there at nighttime.
That's better than driving without headlights. Let me tell you about that.
Oh, totally. No, I did that once. I wasn't without headlights, but I had the old stock headlights in there, and I couldn't see anything. I ended up having to get out of the vehicle with an LED flashlight and walking around to find the reflectors. So
yeah, I was driving back without headlights because of my fuse issue, and I was like, I don't want to turn on any electronic. Like, I turned my stereo off. I wasn't running headlights, and it was like 10 o'clock at night.
Jeez.
And I had like this horrible little flashlight, and I don't know why I didn't think of it, but I have a big mag light right behind me, but I was just like, I got a flashlight. And then, I know the trail well enough to kind of know where I should be.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because I was with the other people I was with. I was like, no, you guys got to go left up there. Like, you get the wrong way. Like, you know, I'm going blind and I already know where they're going wrong.
The place that I get, always turned around in at nighttime on the Rubicon is at the top of the ledges, from the top of the ledges on the other side of the bowl to the top of that really steep uphill left turn.
The granite climb.
The granite climb. So between like 100 yards, 200 yards past the granite climb and the ledges, I get super confused and turned around no matter like what time of day it is.
Sure. Yeah, I got lost because we did the bypass for a little sluice just because we had the steering issue and my truck was going bad, and I never go that way.
Oh, okay.
Right? And so I'm like, you know, like a little sluice is you just point it and you go.
Yeah.
You know, like you either climb a cliff or you climb this like little ledge, you know, and out on the bypass, there's like 10 ways that you can go.
Yeah.
So I was getting a little confused out there.
So question for you. Okay. I was going to save this till later, but since we're already in the topic now, when you go through little sluice, the little like group of like four rocks at the very end, what do you do?
You
go driver's side high?
Yeah.
Okay. I tried to go passenger side high And I didn't get quite high enough and got high-centered there for a little bit.
Oh,
and ended
yeah.
up kind of having to spin like a top on that rock on the
okay.
passenger side.
Were you
until I got
stuck
off.
On your rear diff at all with on that other the rock that's in the middle?
Surprisingly, no.
Okay.
I was pretty much just high-centered on my slider on the passenger side.
Got it.
But I just kind of threw it into crawl and then yeah. just kind of spun like a top whenever I got traction until I came off and pointed off passenger side and climbed... was able to finally climb the rock on the driver's side.
Right.
But another JK we were with got stuck there twice.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, the two Cherokees I was with struggled a little bit, but they're also on 35s. And then I've gone through it so many times that it seems like, you know, it doesn't change all that much. Like, the big rocks are there and they're
yeah.
not moving, but the
yeah.
smaller rocks move around, you know, so I kind of know the line I normally take.
Mm-hmm.
And so... they all hopped out to get ready to take photos, and I was just finishing. They're like, oh my gosh, how'd you get through it so fast?
Yeah, big tires. Big tires are great.
Big tires, longer wheelbase, yeah. you know. I had to explain to them, you know, like, you're on 35s, I'm on 37s. You're like 105, I'm 124-ish.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a big difference. When front and rear tires are trying to climb stuff, my
yep.
rear tires aren't even there yet.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
so they're like, okay, makes sense. But yeah.
Yeah, it was funny. The JK was a four-door JK we were taking through, and he ended up taking the exact same line that I took.
A high passenger. Okay.
And not like super high up on the wall there,
mm-hmm.
just over those two rocks there, and got high-centered right where I did, except he ended up getting completely turtled where his tires were completely off the ground. So he had to get winched
right.
backwards off of
oh.
it. And then he tried to go really high passenger up on the wall
yeah.
and kind of boof around that rock. And we told him, we're like, no, you got to go higher. You got to go higher. He goes, this is high enough. And we just kind of looked at each other. We're like, okay. And so we're like, you do your thing then.
Yeah.
And so he tried to go over and got turtled really bad, like right on his belly pan and his drive shaft and everything. And that's when everybody came down finally and started picking on him and hazing him. And he was just sitting there. And after a while, he was taking it like a champ. And he was just like, blah, blah, yeah, okay, guys, yeah, okay, guys. And then we started taking pictures. He goes, really? Are you guys going to post these online? We're like, heck yeah, we are. And then we just kept hazing him. And I felt kind of bad for him after a while, but eventually he goes, you guys are a bunch of dicks. There was like 10 of us, something like
yeah.
that. But, yeah, so we ended up pulling him off backwards. And then there was an awesome Tacoma, first-gen Tacoma, built very similar to my dad's Tacoma that was with us. And he was on 37s. 125-inch wheelbase, something like that. And I made him go high driver side, which
mm-hmm.
is what you just said. And he just went through it no problem. Everyone was like, what the heck? The Toyotas don't have any problem getting through here. We're like, yeah, it's a Toyota
yeah.
thing. We don't expect Jeeps to understand.
Yeah, there's a chunk of rocks, or there's some really big rocks a little bit before that.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
I do high passenger there.
Okay, yep.
And
yeah,
then I cross, like, you know, cross the lane, you know, over to... you know, as almost as far as you can go within a foot or so to the cliff.
Yeah.
And then I'm high driver side the
yeah.
rest of the way up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's what I ended up having the Tacoma do. And he just went right through like it was nothing. And everyone was like, really?
Yeah. You do get, I mean, you are pretty off camber when you're climbing that one big
yeah.
rock.
Yeah.
You know, and right as you get to the top, and then you've got to climb, I think it's you got a driver's side front has, or passenger side front has to climb another rock.
As you
so
go
you're
over
getting
it,
really
yep.
twisted. But yeah, that's, for me, that's the best route to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to try that one next time I go through. So, yeah, that was fun. We had a really fun trip on the Rubicon that day. We went in and out to Buck Island, and due to traffic and spending an hour in Little Sluice, 45 minutes in Little Sluice, and an hour and a half on Soup Bowl playing around.
Oh, yeah.
Did
you
took
make
us,
it?
I didn't go because my toolbox still isn't bolted down in the back of my rig yet. So
okay.
I'm like, I know how much Little Sluice throws you on your side
yeah.
in order to get up that thing. I was like, if my toolbox goes over, it's going to kill me. So so I didn't go up Little Sluice. Everybody else tried it, though. The Jeeps made it up. The Samurai did not make it up.
Yeah.
The Tacoma walked right up it, no problem.
Nice.
And then the two first-gen 4Runners, we were just kind of like, I was saying I didn't want my toolbox hitting me and killing me. And the other guy was like, I just don't really ever like working on my rigs, so I'm just going to stay and run the trail.
Yeah.
So, but we had fun at Soup Bowl for a little bit. And then it ended up taking us 6 hours to get to Buck Island just because
wow.
we were just goofing off and
yeah.
stopping a lot. But then when we came back from Buck Island, it took us 3.5 hours to
okay.
get out to the chalet.
Okay.
So from Buck Island to the chalet, and we had about a 45 minutes worth of stops for me to stretch out my back. Yeah. So really, it was like 2 hours and 15 minutes, 2 hours and a half to get back from Buck Island to the chalet. So that was fun. So
wow, that's fast.
It was fast, and the 4Runner did awesome. I ran the whole trail pretty much like in second gear, which is I've never been able to do that before in the 4Runner.
Yeah,
turns
well,
out
four, you're in your 4.7K second gear.
I'm in my 4.7K second gear,
right?
Which is essentially your a regular stock 2.28 in first gear. A little tiny bit lower than that, but
yeah, but your engine's turning twice as fast.
Yeah,
exactly. So it helps immensely to crawl over. Like when you hit a little rock, mm-hmm. it has your engine still and the flywheel and everything still has the momentum to carry you over that rock. Where if you're in the stock 2.28, you just die.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
So a couple of things. This is the first trip I've done on the new spark plugs and the advanced timing, right?
Okay.
So, because I did the advanced timing before, and I was like, I didn't really feel that much of a difference with it.
Right.
But turns out, my Father's Day trip, I had two really, really bad spark plugs.
Right.
So, this was the first trip on the new spark plugs and the advanced timing, and it makes a world of difference.
Okay. Good. Good to
so
hear.
So, being able to wheel that, I was able to drive up the Ice House Road and in third gear and past a few people.
Wow.
Which was awesome. I was like, I've never done that before. And it literally cut like 20, 25 minutes off of my drive time to the Rubicon, which was pretty cool. So it all worked great. Everything's great. I ran the AC all day long with no issues. I had to turn it off going up Walker Hill just because it's a really long climb.
Yeah.
So I had to turn it off for there. That's
Did
where
you
I started
do it
having.
Because of the heat?
Because I was having overheating issues.
Okay.
Which, as some of you know, I've been kind of struggling with overheating issues for a while now, pretty much since I've had the rig.
Yes.
And I've done new thermostats and a new radiator. I've now switched out the fans as well. And I have new fans in there, new electric fans. And they put out like twice as much air as my old ones did. And I still had overheating issues going up Walker Hill. So I was like, whatever. I just turned off the AC and it was fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
I finally figured out what my overheating issues are.
Yeah. I think I saw this on Instagram.
I did. Yeah, you did. I have a blown head gasket.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure I've had that blown head gasket since I've had the rig for 2.5 years, over 50, 70 wheeling trips, something like that, over 2.5 years. And the engine is still running with a blown head gasket.
Yeah.
And
that's
it runs
crazy.
Just fine without running the AC. Only when I run the AC does it have overheating issues.
Hmm.
And it was just really funny because the block tester, right? You have a video of that.
Yep.
Go check it out on the Snail Trail YouTube channel. But I went and rented a block tester.
Yeah.
And the instructions say after you start the vehicle and it's circulating coolant, to squeeze that little bulb on top to draw air through for 2 minutes.
Right.
Before you figure out the answer whether or not you have a blown head gasket.
Yeah.
The first squeeze of the bulb, the whole liquid turned bright yellow.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
I was sitting there for 2 minutes squeezing this bulb.
Yeah. Yeah. So I
had to switch hands because it hurt. I was getting tired.
Oh, man. It was just really funny. And so I was like, well, I guess I don't have to sit here for 2 minutes. It's one squeeze. It's bright yellow.
Wow.
So, blown head gasket. And now that I know kind of like, that it's blown. I smelled the coolant after I drained it because then I pulled the radiator to put in new fans.
Mm-hmm.
And the radiator just smells extremely like exhaust.
Okay.
The fluid does and all the fluid does and inside the radiator. And I was like, oh yeah, if I just paid attention to how it smelled, I would have figured it out earlier. But so I have a blown head gasket. It's been blown for 2.5 years. And I've done all these wheeling trips and all this driving, my 1,000-mile round trip to Pismo. And so I have another trip this weekend. I'm just going to go because I'm like...
It's been running fine for so long. That's sort of how I am on my rear axle.
Yeah, pretty
it's
much,
like,
right?
I have this crack in there and I know it's there and it's been working fine for years,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And... I mean, I needed to throw it under there so I could do the wheeling trip a few weekends ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, now I just have to find the right axle and fix it up and do it the right way to put it underneath.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still working fine, you know, which is amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, that was a couple of my funny things from this week, this last week with everything I've been up to. So other than my drive shaft losing bolts again.
Again?
Yeah.
All right. So see that now you can't blame it on me.
No.
Last time you blamed it on me, or two times ago, I think you blamed it on me.
I did. I had to stop at, there's a Chevron right there on Highway 50 near the Ice House Road, the Rubicon exit there.
The Frog Pond?
Yeah, the Fresh Pond.
Fresh Pond, yeah.
So I got on Highway 50 and I got up to about 50, 55 miles an hour and had a really bad vibration in my drivetrain. So I pulled off at the Fresh Pond Chevron there where they have tons of light and everything was there.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was coming to a stop, that's when I realized that my wheel wasn't squeaking anymore. But then I heard this as I was stopping. I was like, oh, that's not good. But I crawled under the rig and I was missing a drive shaft bolt and two of them were loose. And I was like, what the hell, man? So
I think you need to do lock washers and Loctite and nylon locks.
I think I'm going to have to do nylocks with them too. I'm using the same, it ends up being the same fit bolt that I use on my bead locks. So I use the same beadlock bolt, grade 8, and the flange nuts that I use on my beadlocks. And so I have spares of those. So I just pulled out another one and put them into the drive shaft and it works just fine.
Maybe you should try to get actual drive shaft bolts.
That's just, you know, that's outside of the Toyota way of doing things, Jimmy.
They're also expensive.
They are super expensive.
But I mean, if they don't come off while you're driving, it might be worth it.
Maybe. We'll see. I don't like the way
you're
throwing logic at me right now.
I've never had a drive shaft bolt come loose, and I use actual drive shaft bolts.
Well, I was using... No, that's right. We did swap out my drive shaft bolts when I put in my parking brake. Okay. Fair. Fair point. But I have to get longer bolts because regular drive shaft bolts won't fit. I need to get longer ones. So,
and they're only going loose on the top too, huh?
Yeah, they're only going loose on the top, so not the bottoms. So yeah, I don't know. I'm going to try
lock washers, nylon locks, and Loctite.
Yeah, they're never coming up. I have to heat them up and melt the nylon in
there.
And
if that doesn't work, we're welding it.
There we go. Oh man. So yeah, that was my week last week and the extent of my excitement with my Rubicon run and everything. So what have you been up to?
Well, last weekend was 4th of July.
It was. Happy 4th. Happy birthday, America.
Woo! And I didn't really do any wheeling, but I went down to Monterey, saw a bunch of college friends.
Saw that old school Willys you saw down there. That was pretty badass.
That thing was sweet.
That was cool.
I've never gotten to drive one of those, and it was a lot of fun to be able to test it and play with it. And,
nice.
You know, it has three gears.
Yeah.
It was in low. Everything. He's like, it's limited slip, and the hubs are locked, but you can climb that hill fine. And I was like, really? And so like, I just started going, and I just left it in first, and it was in low gear. And it putted along and it went straight up this hill. And and I was super shocked. Like, I was like, this thing's rad. This is so much fun. And he's like, yeah, it goes a max of like 45 miles an hour on the road. And, you know, it just puts along. And he's like, he's going to do a little bit of work to it, but he wants to make it all clean and like restore it.
Nice.
But it's sweet.
Are we going to have to get an old Willys now?
I would love an
for
old
the show.
Willys. I would love an old Willys. I mean, my YouTube channel is primarily Toyotas or is Toyotas.
We can hide it. We can throw it behind the shop whenever you're recording.
I mean, it might be sacrilege to throw some Toyota axles underneath it. Then could we work that way?
It would fit. They would fit, right?
But no, I've always liked the body lines of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so cool. I would if I had one, I would stretch it. And, and leave it flat fendered out and like just make it, the hard part about me would be like, it's such an iconic, cool vehicle, but what I would want to do to it would be completely modify it in every way.
Yeah, keep the body there and change everything else.
Well, I'd probably want to stretch the body a little too.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, or at least maybe the tub. Like make the tub a little longer.
Yep.
But yeah, I don't. I mean, and
you could
I have
take
a hard
an
part.
FJ45 bed, the pickup bed off the FJ45, and put it on the back of a Willys flatty, and extend the frame.
Yeah.
Then it'd be a Willys FJ.
Now we're talking. Now we're talking. Yeah. I don't know. So I would love one of those one day. But I have a hard time modifying it like pretty extensively.
Yeah.
Because it's such an iconic and old vehicle that it, I would feel bad to like take this thing that's has such a heritage, you know, and if you cleaned it up and made it nice, it would still, it'd just be as good. And, you know, and to make it, to modify it and tweak it and edit it. That's one of the hard things I have with my BMW obsession.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My, I have always, as you know, I've always wanted a 1973, BMW 2002.
Uh-huh.
But I would have to find one that's like been salvaged or something because I want to slam it. I want to drop an, like a M3 motor into it.
Nice.
I want to just, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of people cut holes in the doors to put speakers and that's something I would probably want to do, you know, and, you know, all those things ruin the, like the value of the, a pristine vehicle.
Yeah.
And, but that's not what I want it for, right?
Yeah.
Like, I want it to do these other modifications too.
Well, you can get one, and then what we'll do is we'll just have a competition with Dirthead Dave and his Comet.
Yeah.
And see who can slam a better vehicle.
Yeah, he can.
He can.
I've only ever lifted them, so this would be the first vehicle I would have ever lowered.
Yeah.
So, well, that's not true. I guess I, technically I lowered Bobcat 1 inch.
Yeah. Well, you lowered Lloyd after...
Yeah.
After raising him with the torsion bars, you lowered the torsion bars and then put ball joint spacers on him
and raised it back up. But, yeah. But, yeah. No, I don't know. It would, both of them would be really cool to have one day, but no, nothing anytime soon in the future. So.
Okay. Well, cool. So you had your trip down to
Monterey.
Monterey.
Yeah. It was funny because I phoned up my phone, my buddy, and I said, "Hey, I'm coming." He's like, "Oh, okay. We don't really have room for you in the house." And I was like, "No problem. I'll bring my rooftop tent. I'll sleep in your driveway."
There you go.
And he's like, "Perfect."
Nice.
Yeah. And he got a new house, up on the side of a hill outside of Salinas.
Nice.
A little ways, a ways out of Salinas actually, but, gorgeous, gorgeous view, beautiful land. He has a rad pool in his backyard and I'm super stoked for the guy. It's such a, it's such a beautiful area.
That's cool.
So, yeah. And then we went into town on, so that was Thursday night, right? 4th of July. On the Friday, we went down into Monterey and hung out. And then, there's a campground actually in Monterey, back behind one of the military bases.
Okay.
And it's, called the Veterans Memorial Campground or something along those lines.
Okay.
And it's usually first come, first serve. I'm like, 4th of July weekend and we're going to stroll
yeah,
up
good luck.
Like that. And I'm like, yeah. And, but they had a spot. And so we're like, wow, okay, sweet. So we ended up camping there for a night and it was like a $5 Uber ride down to downtown Monterey. And we went out on the street and had some fun and ended up strolling back, you know, and crawling into the rooftop again and driving home the next day. So it was a, short trip, but it was a lot of fun. We had a great time.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you posted that picture that Willie's like that day or the next day or something, I saw one that was in pristine condition, like mid 40s flatty Willie's, and I was like, oh, and I was trying to get my picture, my phone out, take a picture real quick, and it drove off already, and I was like, dang it.
Nice.
But yeah.
Yeah, my buddy actually has an old small military trailer also.
Oh, nice.
So he's gonna put it behind the Willie's.
Nice. We got to get together and build a trailer, build a small trailer and see what we can do.
I've always wanted to.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to have a little trailer, especially something there. Like if I wheel out with a trailer, like if I pull a trailer on the Rubicon, well, one of the biggest things, let me back up. If I take the rooftop tent on the Rubicon, I don't want to really have to collapse it to go wheeling at night or to go wheeling the next day, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's where a trailer option becomes really nice, especially if you're leaving a base camp.
Yeah. And, right? Any kind of base camp scenario, a trailer with a rooftop tent on top of it is awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and so like even, you know, moving a rooftop tent's not very difficult, you know, or opening and closing it for the day. And it's not difficult, but it's just more of a hassle than if you could just leave it in one spot.
Yeah.
So,
question for you, speaking of hassles and rooftop tents.
Okay.
Our good buddy, Mr. Truck Norris.
Yes.
Mike, he made a post recently that, he was out on a camping trip and forgot his rooftop tent or didn't bring it for whatever reason.
Okay.
And he ended up tent camping, regular tent camping. And he has a pop-up tent like I have. So just, you literally spring loaded, it pops up for you. And like, so you're set up in like less than 2 minutes with a tent.
Okay.
Wow. And he said that he really enjoyed being able to walk in and out of his tent, not have to climb ladders and go pee in the middle of the night kind of thing.
Yeah.
Curious, now that you've had your rooftop tent for a while, do you think that that's something that is worth it to give up, being able to walk in and out of your tent and get up in the middle of the night to go pee and not have to find a ladder in the dark and everything?
That's a good question. And the thing is, I don't usually go to the bathroom at night.
Okay.
I do,
but that's usually because I'm drinking a lot right before I go to bed.
Well, the thing is that you have to make more of a conscious decision, or more, you have to be somewhat coherent to go, well, I'm about to climb up a ladder and put myself to bed. I need to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
Right?
See, I usually don't make those decisions, those coherent decisions.
But it's harder to go down when you're a little groggy.
Yeah.
But after you've gone down to go to the bathroom, you're a little bit more awake. So going back up's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, totally. If you're a person that, you know, does go to the bathroom every night in the middle of the night after you've gone to bed, you know, a ground tent is much easier.
Okay.
On that aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's still some advantages for the rooftop. Like, I really enjoy having a 3-inch foam mattress all the way across my bed.
I could see that being really nice.
That I don't like my, if I sleep on my side all night long, I will bottom out on the metal on the bottom.
Okay.
But I move around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never really bottom out that foam mattress.
Nice.
And so I sleep way better in that rooftop tent than I do on a blow up air mattress or my camping mattress and things of that nature. And it's, I would, you know, I'm not sure what tent you have, but, if I brought one of my backpacking tents, they're warm, but this tent is really warm too.
Okay.
So if you go out on it, like the first night I bought that tent, I ended up sleeping in 20 degree weather with all my clothes on, granted, and, a mattress pad.
Yeah, as a comforter.
As my comforter. And I survived. Like, it wasn't bad.
Nice.
You know, and I woke up and I was driving into town to go find some coffee because it was freezing. And the temperature thing said like 23.
Nice.
You know, and I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
You know, and the tent holds in the heat really well.
Nice. Okay. That's a good positive. I didn't even think about it, the holding in the heat aspect of it. I just know that every time I see people out wheeling where I'm at and they have rooftop tents set up, at night I want to go over and remove their ladders in the middle of the night.
That's funny.
So
the benefit about not depending on what wheeling they're doing, right?
Yeah.
I've always been hesitant to add the rooftop tent to the crawler because I do some, I like, if I do soup bowl, how's another 150 200 pounds gonna be, you know, up high on my truck?
Yeah.
You know, how's that going to interact with things?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always been this hesitation to me to pull it out and for a crazy off-roading trip like that.
Yeah.
Like if I'm going to take the rooftop on Rubicon, I might not be doing Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Right. Just because I don't want, you know, I've got this added 200 pounds up high. Like I don't want to lean over really far.
Yeah. True.
And my ground tent, you know, that's 200 pounds and my ground tent weighs
5 pounds.
Yeah. You know, or if I'm hammocking it, it's like 3 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, and I bring the hammock regardless. So 8 pounds total for both of the tents, you know?
Yeah.
And I actually, you know, like I didn't bring the rooftop last time. And when I was out on the Rubicon, I was planning on hammocking it and it was so windy. I was like, I'm just going to set my tent up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah, it's, I mean, it's a lot. It's easy. Both of them are easy.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that there's more of a luxury with the rooftop.
While you're actually sleeping?
Yeah, while you're actually sleeping.
Okay.
And for setting up and tearing down. I mean, but yours, your tent, it sounds like it's super easy to set up and tear down.
It's super easy to set up and tear down. The only thing that I found is a pain in the butt, but I think I fixed it now, is airing it up. Mm-hmm. Airing up my mattress, I should say.
Yeah.
And
just stick it up to your exhaust.
Yeah, pretty much. Just put exhaust fumes in it all night and leaks all night and I get really high while I'm sleeping.
No. Yeah. Great dreams.
No, I just hook it up to my onboard air system and I have a little hose, but I don't have the right fitting for the hose to air up the mattress efficiently.
Yeah.
So now what I've done, I found a little like a $5-$10 portable air mattress pump with batteries and a switch. So I'm like, okay, I'll just keep that in my drawer, my toolbox, and pull that out.
You know what else those are good for? Is starting fires.
When
you're leaning over and you're blowing on the fire to get it going, you just turn on that little air compressor thing. The fire just gets massive.
You know what also starts the fires really well?
Gasoline.
Chainsaw gasoline. I lost some eyebrows and some hand hair that day.
Don't do that, ladies and gentlemen.
I was trying to avoid doing that.
Play safe.
The electric taser lighter worked awesome, though.
Oh, I bet. That thing's cool. What air mattress do you use?
I literally got one from Walmart for $8.
It's like a little
Coleman $8.
How big does it loft?
Not that big, because that was my original issue. I was like, I want a really fluffy, thick air mattress, and it was too much air in there. I was never able to warm it up at night, so it was always cold.
Okay.
The air got cold inside the mattress. So this one is about half the thickness of my original one, so maybe 4 inches thick.
Okay.
And it's about the size of an 8-foot long table. But
3 feet wide.
Yeah, 3 feet wide, 8 feet long, somewhere right around there.
Yeah.
And it works great. $8. It's lasted me 2 years so far. And
cool.
Yeah.
I kind of did my view on off-roading and backpacking was I can use all my backpacking supplies for off-roading, but I couldn't use all my off-roading supplies for backpacking.
Yeah.
So, I just use a Neo Air, which lofts up about 2 inches. And is, you know, like 16 or 20 inches wide.
Yeah.
And, 7 feet long or so.
Yeah.
But it packs up to the size of a Nalgene.
Yeah.
You know, so my comparison is sleeping on that.
Okay.
Or sleeping on the foam mattress
in your tent,
in the rooftop.
Yeah, that makes sense. I used to use a Big Bertha air mattress, which is a big popular backpacking brand.
Yeah,
mainly because I got it to do backpacking down the Feather River, up out of Quincy area, and a big part about backpacking the Feather River, which is just this is a side talk, completely off topic, is that there's lots of places where you can't hike along the river; you have to jump in the river, and float through down the river in order to get around these cliffs and point areas. You can't climb up the cliff. So it's really awesome. But I needed a really robust backpacking mattress to be able to put my pack on it and myself on it and float down the river without soaking my pack.
Got it.
So that's what I used for a really long time. And
why didn't you just get a dry bag?
Because I didn't want to carry that along with everything else. And so I just figured it was easier to have a mattress dual purpose thing and use it that way.
A floaty and air mattress.
Yeah. That's cool to know the pluses and minuses or just the pluses and drawbacks.
The positive and positives, negatives, whatever. Yeah.
Of a rooftop tent versus regular tent. But
I think, I like it. I like it for more overlanding style.
Yeah.
But when I'm going out rock crawling and or aggressive off-roading, I think a ground tent is nice. Okay. Now, so what is going to be interesting is if I end up doing the Transamerica Trail or anything, and you have to move every single day.
Yeah.
What am I going to end up doing? Because what's really nice about the rooftop tent is I can fold it up with all the bedding inside of it. And I can leave it there. I pull out the pillows, but I leave the mattress pad and the sheets and the comforter, and I leave that all in there and fold it all up.
Nice. You can also fold up your car keys in there too. We had a guy do that on our my off-roading club's club picnic last year out on Deer Valley. This guy brought an off-road trailer with a rooftop tent on top of it, and he was the only guy with a rooftop tent. He was like the whole weekend long. It started raining, right? And he put up his chair underneath the little the half part that folds out of his rooftop tent. And he goes, "I'm dry." And he was just lounging back and kind of poking fun at all of us the whole weekend long. He goes, "Oh, yeah, no, I got a great night's sleep and blah, 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 this and that and this and that." When we came down time to leave on Sunday morning, he had folded up his keys in his rooftop tent.
And he couldn't find them.
And he couldn't find them forever. And we're all sitting there waiting for him to find his keys. And finally, he opened up the tent and they were inside the tent.
The
and
pocket.
So we're never going to let him live that down.
That's funny.
Dave folding up his keys in his tent.
I've done that with a flashlight and a headlamp. Oh, yeah. Separate times and nice. Being like, where is this? I can't find it. Usually it's in this bag. And then open the tent up and go to sleep. I'm like, oh, here
hey,
it is.
My flashlight.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
But
well, cool. Before we get to today's campfire discussion, I have a couple of kind of news bulletins, news updates, which I think are really important. We don't do too much of news stuff on the show just because, I don't know, it can be monotonous, kind of hard to be entertaining with the news stuff, but
right, and it's a lot of times it's like general or it's focused in location based,
it's very location based. And so these, we have three items today that we really want to cover because they are really important to you guys out there, especially one of them. So we'll leave that one for last. The first two are going to be kind of ham radio related. Last year in September, Baofeng, the super popular cheap $25 radio you can get on Amazon, they got in trouble by the FCC for marketing unlicensed radios. Not really unlicensed radios. They were in violation of their license for the radios.
Okay.
So they were licensed as ham radios, Part 97, by the FCC standards, but they come unlocked, right? And so you can run anything on them, any frequency you want, pretty much.
Right.
And so they got in trouble, and they were levied some very heavy fines. I think it came in total of $100,000 to $150,000. Wow. Went by the time it was all said and done. And they were given 1 year to sell off their inventory before they're banned from selling anymore.
Okay.
So that time limit is coming September 2019. As of September 2019, you will not be able to purchase Baofeng radios anymore in the United States.
Wow. Or can you, if they, is there an, I mean, this is sort of off topic. Uh-huh. If they have, can they set frequencies in the radios and sell the radio?
That's all they would have to do.
Okay.
Is they would have to, but then they'd have to get more license grants, right? They'd have to get a Part 97, a Part 90, a Part 95 grant for a commercial radio, for a ham radio, for an FRS radio, a MERS radio. But yeah, that's all they would have to do. And then create the same radio they've been creating, but lock the frequencies through the software at whatever that license grant is for a commercial FRS, MERS, or ham.
Right.
And then it's easy enough for on the user end to unlock the radios.
Which is illegal.
Which is, it's theoretically illegal. Most people that do it, though, understand why they're doing it and understand the repercussions of transmitting on the incorrect frequencies.
Okay.
So, but yeah, that's all they would have to do is release radios that are locked by frequency already. Okay.
So coming up here soon is their 1 year.
They're coming up on 1 year where either...
Do you know what they're going to do?
Nope, there hasn't been any news yet on it. So
if you're looking to get an open radio, you have only a few more months. Is that what the...
You have only a few more months. And if you do get one of those radios, please, 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 please email me, tyler@snailtrail4x4.com or tyler@myoffroadradio.com. And I will get you the open use frequencies that will essentially turn your radio into a really nice FRS or MERS radio, so that at bare minimum you are on the correct frequencies and you're not going to end up accidentally transmitting on top of local PD or fire departments or ambulances or tow companies or taxi companies or logging companies or campgrounds in the area. So
I told you the story that we were doing that, right?
That you were doing...
We were transmitting on a PD.
Oh, local PD?
A local...
No?
Yeah.
JJ, what are you doing over there?
I was up with some friends and who also have their ham radio license.
Okay.
And I said, what frequency are you guys on? And they told me what frequency, and I keyed it into my radio.
Okay.
And then we were talking, and one of my buddies has a radio in his rig, so he's a little bit more higher powered, and I'm just on the Baofeng.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, are you guys hearing this come through? And I'm like, no, I don't hear anything. He's like, we need to move the channel. And I'm like, okay. And so we all got together and we talked about what channel we were going to move to. Mm-hmm. And then later he was like, I forgot that was totally the radio, that's the frequency channel that we use for our police station.
Oh, no.
Luckily, I mean, we were a long ways away from where he works, but he just never changed it. And that's what he keyed into his radio, was his local police station.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, that's kind of the drawbacks of the Baofengs, right? They're nice because they come unlocked. You can put in whatever frequency you want. Yeah. So they're very user-friendly in mm-hmm. that regard. But on the downside, they're unlocked. You can put in whatever frequency you want. And right. if you put in a police dispatch frequency, that's what you're going to be on. Mm-hmm. You may be on it unknowingly. So
yeah.
If you have a Baofeng out there, please send me an email. I'll give you the programming list free of charge to make sure they're operating at least on legal frequencies. So,
cool.
So that's the Baofeng update. There's another update going on amongst in the world right now. The World Radio Communications Conference set for 2023. So, you know, a couple years off here, sure. 4 years off. One of the agenda items proposed is to reassign the 144 through 146 megahertz as primarily an aeronautical mobile service allocation. So essentially, commercial airplane flights.
Yeah.
To reallocate that frequency spectrum, 144 to 146 megahertz, to commercial airplanes.
Right. And so what's that mean for the ham radio?
It means that ham radio would not have 2 meters anymore.
Okay.
Which is a huge blow to ham radio.
Right.
Massive, because almost every repeater, at least the United States, if not the world, almost every single ham radio repeater will operate on that 2 meter frequency. It's a very, very popular frequency for ham radio repeaters, which as off-roaders is what we use ham radio for, is the repeaters, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So if that goes through, it still has 4 years, so they still have, you know, public comment to go through and other things, and other let organizations chime in. Mm-hmm. But so far, there's only one organization that's chimed in and said, that's a really bad idea, you guys. We should not give the 144 to 146 megahertz over to commercial airplanes.
Yeah.
And that's the IARU, I always forget what that stands for. The International Amateur Radio Union. So they lobby for ham radio on a global scale.
Cool.
The ARRL lobbies on the United States scale with the FCC. If that goes through and that passes, you can say goodbye to 2 meters as a ham radio.
Right. So we'd usage. Just be on 70 centimeters?
We'd be on 70 centimeters. And on the West Coast, you pretty much can't use 70 centimeters. Because of all the Air Force bases we have on the West Coast and the over-the-horizon radar systems that they use works very closely in that 70-centimeter range.
Got it.
So we are very, very limited on what we can use, what kind of power, where we can point our antennas for 70 centimeters on the West Coast here.
Hmm.
So if 2 meters goes away, pretty much the whole entire world is going to have to convert to 1.25 meters, which there's a lot of repeaters already converting to that, especially on the East Coast.
Okay.
But it's going to have a massive infrastructure change for ham radio in 2023 if that passes. So that's another thing, just to kind of keep on the horizon to kind of see how that plays out over the next few years. And then the big one, which is kind of a scary one in my opinion, is Oceano Dunes.
Yeah.
If you're in anywhere in the off-roading industry, if you're on social media at all, or on social media, off-roading pages, Facebook pages, Instagram pages, whatever it is, you've heard about what's going on at Oceano Dunes. It's now been in the New York Times as well.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, it's not a bill. It's not a law that's trying to pass. It's literally the California Coastal Commission, the CCC, is trying to close down Oceano Dunes to beach OHV usage.
Yeah.
No
more driving out there. No more camping out
no
there.
No more driving. No more camping. They're already, like, they're trying to effective immediately, like pretty much like within the next couple of weeks, shut down the entire Oceano Dunes for night at all. Mm-hmm. So no more night usage of the beach or the dunes at all.
Right.
And that's kind of the first step. They've been trying to shut down Oceano Dunes for a long time. They've already cut it down to a fifth of the size that it used to be.
Right.
I think we have something like 1,500 acres right now, and it used to be something like 20,000 acres, maybe a little less,
wow.
10,000, 20,000, somewhere in that. It used to be a massive area. It's been cut down a lot over time here. And what's funny is the reasoning that they're using to try and shut down Oceano Dunes.
Yeah.
So
it was the lights are bothering the nocturnal animals.
Yes.
Or the plants that are trying to sleep.
So yeah, it was the lights and the noise are bothering nocturnal animals in the dunes that are trying to sleep at night.
But aren't nocturnal animals awake at night?
Yes. Okay. And yes, exactly. And that our lights were bothering dune plants at night. They weren't able to go through a correct photosynthesis process of resting during the night when they're trying to sleep in their photosynthesis process.
And in addition.
So in addition to that, those are the claims that they're trying to shut down the beach at night, like effective immediately.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So, and then, they're trying to shut down, camping, as the first kind of stage, but ultimately they're trying to shut it down overall because of due to dust particles and dust particulate entering into the main town of Pismo. And what's been going on is, Pismo has grown a ton in the past 10 years.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people moving out there, a lot of housing developments that have started to building and really exploding the population of Pismo. And people that are moving in there are upset about how much sand
they get in their
backyard. In their backyard and their front yards and in their houses. And they are claiming that all the sand in their front yards and backyards and houses would stop if there was nobody using the dunes for off-roading purposes.
Right.
So they're claiming that the sole purpose that they have sand in their houses is that there's off-roaders kicking up the sand in the dunes, and the wind, once the sand is kicked up, then the wind carries the sand into their houses.
You know, if there were no off-roaders, there wouldn't be any wind.
That is true. You know, we're just going so fast through the dunes that we're really creating the wind.
Right?
So
that's what's carrying.
No, it's just, it's completely bullshit. And, you know, I don't like to curse a lot on this podcast, but it is 100% bullshit. It's equivalent to moving into near an airport.
Yeah.
And then bitching and complaining about the airplane noise and the jets taking off near your house, keeping you up at night.
Right.
Don't move in next to a fucking airport if you don't want the goddamn planes keeping up at night. Sorry. I feel like this is a rant session from the Wheeling Wine and Whiskey podcast. Yeah.
Well, what's really bad about this is that if this does go through, then it does not stop there.
It doesn't. And that's the scary part. So the best way to think of it is, I don't know how to describe it. It's a domino effect, really. The
really
way
is.
Legislation works across this country is that people keep trying to pass legislation. They try and pass new laws. They lobby for new laws. Once something passes, the language from that legislation, that law, gets used by other people across the country to do the exact same goal of whatever that goal was to achieve that goal in their parts of the country.
Right.
My fiance works in anti-tobacco legislation, and this is what they do. They figure out what language works to pass anti-tobacco legislation and policies, and then they take, once something's successful, they disseminate it across the country to the other states and counties and other organizations across the country. And then they use that language to pass anti-tobacco legislation there. The exact same thing happens for off-roading places as well. So if this is successful, the language that's going to be used to shut down Oceano Dunes is going to get used to shut down Prairie City SVRA and Ocotillo Wells.
Right.
And then countless
other places across the country.
Tons of other places across the country.
You know, because once they find out how to do this, then they can just use that everywhere else that they want to close down any vehicular off-roading areas.
Exactly.
And they now have a piece of ammo to use.
Mm-hmm. It becomes a copy and paste method, and you change a couple of words here and there to adopt it to your local region.
Right.
This is a very important podcast. If you guys do nothing else, listen to this part right here. We are going to include in the show notes. So look on your podcasting app, your phone, whatever you're listening to right now. The notes that come along with this podcast when you downloaded it and hit the play button. In that window there, I'm going to put a bunch of emails for you guys. Just write a template and say, hey, you know, we really can't be doing this as Americans. We really rely on our outdoor recreation. Keep it to, you know, this is our land, our country. The Bureau of Land Management, you know, keeps land in trust for us. The California Coastal Commission should be doing the same thing to keep recreational opportunities available for the people in this country. Fight for the land for you, for your family, for your friends, for your childhood growing up. put all those into this into emails and send this email to all these emails I'm going to put in the show notes.
Right, because a lot of what is being said is that the off-roaders don't care if this doesn't get closed either.
Exactly.
And so we need, as the off-roading community, we need to come and support. And if you're not in the area, like I'm not down, we're not down in the Pismo area, mm-mm, we need to send emails in and say, I've been to Pismo.
Absolutely.
I enjoy going off-roading. Mm-hmm. I use areas just like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you're not, you know, even if you're in on the East Coast, you know, and say, hey, I don't, you know, I don't live in that area, but there are places out here that I go and enjoy, and it's just would be a shame to be able to close something like that.
Absolutely.
You know, and just, mm-hmm, you just have to, we have to let them know that it is a big deal to the off-roading community that they would shut that thing down.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So, like Jimmy said, they're the other side is claiming that off-roaders don't care whether something gets shut down or not. So let's make sure that they know that we do care. We are paying attention, and we don't want our outdoor recreation opportunities to be shut down on us. So check out those emails and check out a couple of the organizations that are really putting, you know, the fist to dirt or feet to dirt, whatever that expression is called. I'm getting too fired up here.
I know you really are getting emotional over this. There are some really good organizations, yes, out there that are supporting the off-roading community, especially here in California.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've got Corva,
Cal 4-Wheel, and Friends of Oceano, Friends, mm-hmm, of the Dunes, Friends of Oceano Dunes. I believe it's Friends of,
right,
Oceano Dunes.
Yeah.
They are pouring money into lawyers to fight Oceano Dunes closing right now, Corva and Friends of Oceano Dunes. So if you, mm-hmm, feel like giving, you know, just $5, anything helps, because they are spending a lot of money out right now on lawyers and legislation to fight this.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
And support the organizations that are putting in the good fight.
Yeah,
so.
And I would say, you know, if this isn't your fight and you live somewhere else, put some money into a local one in your area.
Absolutely.
Because they are going to, if this goes through, then it's going to come down to the people in your area to fight against these organizations that are trying to close mm-hmm, down the off-roading places where you live.
100%.
And so we've got to support them.
Absolutely. So that's our kind of our rant for today, our call for action, our plea for help, because this is becoming a very tense situation. Literally, the meeting that's going to decide this is in 4 days from when we're recording. Oh. July 13th is when this meeting is down in Pismo. So if you're in the Central California, even Northern Cal, SoCal area, if you're in the area and can show up to this July 13th meeting, please do.
Yeah.
100%. If you're not there, please write in your emails before July 13th so that they know that we do care about our outdoor recreation opportunities. So,
I mean, from when they hear this, they're going to have 1 day.
You're going to have like 1 day. Yeah. So, try and do it as soon as possible. We'll make it as easy as possible. We'll have all the emails down there and a list of people you can contact and let know that we do care, right there in the show notes there on your phone. So copy and paste that email, put it into an email. It can be short and sweet, something to the effect of, hey, I do care. We as Americans do value our outdoor recreation. Do not take it away from us.
Would it be wrong of us to supply a template?
That's a good question. I would want to check with organizations like Corva or Friends of Oceano Dunes first to see if like anything said in a template could be misconstrued or taken the wrong way before we just do it. But if we can, I'll try and create a template. So I'm going to check with, I know a couple people at Corva that we can check with. I'll check with them, and I'll have a little email template you can copy and paste as well in the show notes.
If we're allowed to do that.
So
we're trying to make it as easy on you guys to just copy these emails, copy this template, mm-hmm, blast out an email, mm-hmm, and let's support the cause.
Yep, 100%. So check that out. And on that note, I hope you guys hung in there for today's discussion. Before we get into the campfire discussion, we have a fun one for you today. That's kind of a, we're taking back off with the Toyota axles. So we're not gonna have too many comparisons to other axles, but hey, we'll get right into it. So take a quick break, go have some coffee, grab your JK lattes if you're out there driving into JKs, and we'll be right on back with today's campfire discussions. Welcome back, ladies, gents, and kiddos, to today's campfire discussion here on the Snail Trail 4x4 podcast. Today, we get to do kind of a follow-up to episode 9 with the Toyota Axle. So we had a little bit of break with the Toyota talk to talk to Dirthead Dave. That was a lot of fun. Hope you guys enjoyed that episode, episode 10. And this episode, we get to kind of talk about, you know, how do you beef up an axle? So we'll read an email here really quick sent in by Benjamin. So Benjamin sent in an email and he says, "Hey, Jimmy and Tyler, love the podcast and YouTube channel. I would really like to hear your thoughts and discussion about building a Toyota solid front axle to handle larger tires, i.e. up to 40 inches. I just converted my 99 extra cab Tacoma from two-wheel drive to four-wheel drive, installed a crawl box in 63 Chevys and bobbed 12 inches off the back, and I plan to build a trail gear front housing with an e-locker, but want to make sure I build it right to hold up to the trails around Colorado and Utah. Also, I know that Bobcat is in the same wheelbase range, so I'm very curious if you're happy with staying on 37s or if you would like to change it. If so, what would you do?" So, are you happy, Mr. JJ, Mr. JJ the Hydrojet? Are you happy? Sorry. Are you happy with your 37s?
I am.
Okay.
But I'm going to 40s.
You're going to 40s just because?
Yeah.
Because you can? Because your t-shirt says what could go wrong?
What could possibly
go wrong? What could possibly go wrong?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. That's a joke that a few college friends of mine will get. Well, I am totally happy with my 37s.
Okay.
And in all reality, that's about as large as a Toyota axle should go, in my opinion.
I agree to that.
Mm-hmm. Now I do know people that are running 40s, and they, as long as the axle is built up well, it can handle it as long as you stay off the skinny pedal.
Yes.
You have to be a gentle driver and not aggressive and not a showboating type of person to be able to make 40s work on Toyota axles.
I agree.
Because you are really, for the most part, exceeding what that axle can do.
Yeah.
Or the capability, the strength of that axle.
Yeah, the metallurgy.
Yeah.
If we want to use fancy words.
37s have been really good to me.
Mm-hmm.
I first put 37s on when 35s were large.
Mm-hmm.
Like when everybody's like, oh, I got 35s.
Ooh,
so
we got
35s. I got 37s, you know, and I felt all like, ooh, high and mighty. And now it's like I have to go to 42s to do that.
Yeah.
But regardless, 37s are great. They do almost everything out here in California. There are places where 37s aren't big enough.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happens, I really should have more horsepower and a bigger axle and 40s to 42s.
Yep.
So I'll let everybody know when I put my 40s on if I see that big of a difference or what's actually what I feel or see happening between my 37s and 40s. But there's only been once or twice that I've needed larger tires.
Okay. You think your squirrels in the engine are going to like the 40s?
You know, no. Especially with the four banger.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of work. And I don't want to change my gearing because there is the option to go for, I'm on 529s now. You can go to 571s, but the gears just get so small.
Yeah. The teeth in
the ring gear get so tiny. I have had friends run those and just break them, like driving down the road almost. And so 529s is beefy enough, but still low enough to be able to handle 37s. 37s and 529s makes my speedometer almost correct. So it's near the exact ratio as a stock vehicle.
Okay.
So going to 40s is going to be like going from 31s to 33s, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a lot more sluggish. It's not going to be as happy, you know, but I think it'll be fun and nice. It'll be worth it to kind of, test it out.
Alrighty. Because I'm curious, because you have your Stage 2 cam in there. So I'm curious to see how much of an impact the 40s really have going from 37s to a 40. Because I know with your 37s, you can still get up and go with Bobcat on the freeway.
Yeah.
You can pass me in the 4Runner just fine. And I'm on 36s. So I'm curious, going from 37s to 40s, if it's really going to have that much of an impact, or with your stage 2 camera or not.
You know, I did reference 31s or to 31s to 33s, but the thing is, it's like 37s to 40s, there's a lot more rubber being added.
Okay. True.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's a few inches like we're talking about, but those few inches are like the circumference gets a lot larger.
That's true. So, pi r squared does not work in your favor in that one.
No. And so that tires are heavier because they're much larger.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I'm going to be running 17 inch rims, you know, so that, you know, just, it's six one way, half a dozen the other, you know. But yeah, I'm curious as well. I just know that I'm not changing my gears. I can't go down.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go any higher because they just become weak and brittle.
100%. So. Cool. So then as you get prepared for 40s, what are you going to do to your front axle, or what would you do to a stock front axle? I know you already have a lot of stuff done to Bobcat's front axle.
Yeah.
What would you do to a stock axle then to get it ready for 40s to really exceed what a Toyota axle should be on and still be okay as long as you're really a careful driver out on the trail?
Yeah, sure. On the Toyota axle, we have Burfields in the Burfield ball. Mm-hmm. And then between the Burfield ball and the axle like housing shaft area, there's a dip, a small little dip between those.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably the weakest part of that axle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I've actually bent an axle jumping in Pismo.
Yeah.
I've bent an axle housing out there in Pismo.
Right there at the ball.
At the spot at the ball.
Okay.
And so they make little gussets.
Mm-hmm.
A few companies make them. Trail Gear makes them. I bet Marlin makes them.
Marlin has them for sure. Yep.
That actually have a little dip that you weld in to support the ball and the housing together. Mm-hmm. And they go on top and on bottom. The top ones have a spot so you can put your shocks into it.
Yeah.
That's probably like the first biggest upgrade I think I would
that's
do.
That's like number one.
Yeah.
Number one thing you should do to your
even
solid
non-37s, I would have that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's when I put my 37s on it, when I first
I would put that on any rig that's going to be off-roading. If you have a solid front axle, I don't care what size tires you have, I'd put those on.
With a Toyota axle.
With a Toyota axle,
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would be my number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then since we're talking about going to 40s, you've got to strengthen that axle every way that you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying, you know, you got to put some trusses on there. If you know, they make ones that are just go support the long side, but if you want to make something custom that goes over the top and, you know, supports both sides, that's probably better. Mm-hmm. You know, any rock protection on top and on the diff cover side, it would be great.
But I'm going to bigger tires, so I'm going to be going over all the rocks then, right?
Absolutely.
I don't need rock protection.
No, not at all. But you're probably going to now go into places that are more difficult.
True.
Because you have bigger tires and you can get to these locations a lot easier.
Is that how those things work?
Yeah.
You build up your rigs and go to more difficult places?
Right, okay. Exactly.
That makes sense.
It's like the more money you make, the more difficult life becomes.
Yes. Yeah.
And from there, I think, you know, now let's talk about internal, like we already talked about going to bigger gears or to, you know, to a 529 range. 488s I think would be too low. 488s is like for 35s in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then any higher, but I mean, depending on what gearing you're doing and how you like that setup, because I know some people that are running 488s and 37s and it's just a trail rig, but they like that because then they can just play with the gearing of their dual T cases and it just gives them a little bit more pep or, you know, a little bit more power out of that area.
Okay.
So, I'm going to stick with 529s. One, it's because it's what I already have. And, two, because I think it'll be a close enough ratio to where I should be.
Okay. Fair enough.
But you could also go at Nitro Gears. Nitro Gears has a 29 spine, ring and pinion setup. I think something along those lines. It's beefier.
Nice.
It's a stronger setup than Just a normal one. So okay. Some normal styles, you know. Mm-hmm. So check that out. That'll help out, especially if you're going, that might be going from the setup from like a 4-cylinder or 6-cylinder third member. Mm-hmm. It might be enhancing it that direction.
Okay.
If I remember right. But I mean, then we can go to chromoly shafts,
mm-hmm.
and chromoly burr fields or mm-hmm. RCV burr fields.
Mm-hmm.
Those are definitely much stronger.
What's the difference between chromoly and RCV?
Yeah, I'm not sure
entirely. So that's a good question. I'm glad you asked, Tyler. The RCVs are actually made, the shafts themselves are made out of 300M,
okay.
which is a metal that is more tough than chromoly.
Okay.
Now, no matter what you do, no matter where you go, wherever you do, wherever you shop, the burr field part where the bearing and everything goes in, that is always going to be at most chromoly.
Okay.
Whether you have 300M RCVs or the Bobby Longfield chromolys or mm-hmm. The Marlin chromoly burr fields, the burr field part is always going to be chromoly, but the shafts on either end can be chromoly, the stock that comes with it, mm-hmm. or 300M.
Got it.
And so your 300M is always going to be your strongest material out there. So if you end up breaking a shaft, a 300M shaft, you're probably going to be breaking the chromoly burr field before you break a 300M shaft.
Got it. Interesting.
Yeah.
I know that chromoly is also has a good spring rate to it.
It does.
So a lot of times they'll like bend and twist before mm-hmm. they'll actually break.
Yeah. So they have a little bit more give than 300M is. 300M is a very stiff, rigid metal as well. It's very strong, but it is very rigid. So it doesn't kind of bend and have a load. It can't handle extreme forces and it'll just shear. Whereas chromoly can kind of warp a little bit and it'll go back to its original shape. So what else would you do?
Well, I think I would do six shooters.
Okay.
On the Toyota front axle.
What are six shooters? You're gonna put guns on there?
Yeah. Six shooters are a bigger, beefier, sold by Trail Gear knuckle.
Okay.
And they're called six shooters because they have six wheel studs or, knuckle studs on the top where mm-hmm. normal knuckles have four.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few other things to do if you don't want to go the Trail Gear route. There's a few companies that do a 5/5 stud, addition, which takes a little bit of fab work. And I would go six shooters or the 5 stud if you're going to do hydro assist, which I would highly suggest with these massive tires.
Yeah.
If you're not going to go hydro assist, I would at minimum do the ARP, ARB,
ARP,
ARP studs
mm-hmm.
on top and bottom, which are supposed to be like the most indestructible stud out yeah. there in the world.
I thought I was the most indestructible stud out there.
Well, I'm going to just leave that one there. but if you're going to go six shooters, you don't necessarily need to go the ARP studs. I would still probably do them though anyway,
okay.
Just cause they're very reliable, very beefy, very nice. That said, I don't have them on mine. And mm-hmm. as long as you check them, for tight, how tight they are and check mm-hmm. them that they're not getting loose, usually the stock studs are strong enough.
Nice. Cause you have a set of six shooters in the shop here.
I do.
Yeah.
And so, those are for Samantha whenever I get around to it.
Oh, I thought those were going to be for the Camry when we build one up.
Camry. Let's sass a Camry.
Sass a Camry, put a 14-bolt under it.
I'm down. Let's Woo-hoo! Do it.
All right.
That would be fun.
Okay. Yeah. So six shooters or the five studs at bare minimum, ARP knuckle studs.
Yes.
And always check your stud tightness, your torque on those. Mm-hmm. What else would you do? Anything else in the knuckles?
Well, there's some good, I would upgrade depending on what, if you're going from, an 85 axle, I would upgrade the brakes, okay. to at minimum the IFS brakes for mm-hmm. the Toyota. But what's cool, and I haven't done a lot of research on, and I'm going to do on to Bobcat, is I'm going to do Tundra brakes.
Oh, nice. Okay.
The first gen Tundra mm-hmm. is a 6-lug bolt pattern, where yep. the second gen is a 5 bolt. I'm yeah. not sure why they did that. but that it's the same bolt pattern as what's on the Toyota axles.
Nice.
And so you can just, you need 17 inch wheels, mm-hmm. and then you can fit the calipers and the discs in there, and you just get a massively bigger rotor and everything nice. Underneath there.
What about the FJ80 rotor options?
I don't know much discs, about them.
Calipers.
I don't know what size they are. I figure the Tundra's much larger, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that that's probably fine. You can do it.
Okay.
I mean,
because I've heard of people doing that. I just don't know how mm-hmm. they compare, how they are in comparison to each other, the T100s or the first gen Tundras to the FJ80 calipers and rotors yeah. and everything. So
I don't know. Okay. To be honest, I'm not sure. And even the T100, I'm not sure what the diameter of the disc is. So, those would be all things that it would be fun to look at and see what the differences are. And the calipers, how big are the calipers? Because, I mean, I have the Tundra ones right down there next to you.
Oh, yeah.
And they're huge. They are huge calipers. And to do that, though, you're going to have to do an upgraded, possibly, brake booster, an mm-hmm. upgraded brake master cylinder, mm-hmm. And possibly some upgraded lines in places. Mm-hmm. So that there's more to that one, you know, than just the easy route for this is to do the IFS disc and brake calipers. And right. that would be the easy route. If you want to go bigger, look at Tundra or possibly the FJ80s.
What about trunnion bearings?
So I've heard mixed reviews on the trunnion bearings and the trunnion bearing eliminators.
I have too. That's why I was curious. I wanted to hear your opinion on it because we didn't really talk about it too much. You and I redid my complete front end, at mm-hmm. least from the knuckles out. We had a knuckle rebuild kit from Marlin, and we got new trunnion bearings and everything. And you had mentioned that they have trunnion bearing eliminators, and I was like, no, I just got the regular trunnion bearings. You're like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And we never really talked about, you know, what are the pluses or negatives of mm-hmm. having a trunnion bearings versus doing the eliminator kit.
Sure. I have the eliminator on mine.
Okay.
The eliminator to me seems like, so let me back up. A bearing is obviously, and those are like needle bearings, right? So they have a long, cylindrical bearing in there. And they have, you know, like 60 of them or whatever mm-hmm. all around. And if you tighten that too hard, those get warped and don't work. Okay. If they're too loose, they, wiggle around and your knuckle is loose.
Okay.
Right? And your steering components aren't right. And a lot of that comes down to the shims and things, how you put it all together. Mm-hmm. If you have the eliminator, the bearings are never going to wear out.
Yeah.
You don't have really the option of things becoming, putting them on too loose or too tight because, okay. I mean, it's still there, but the margin of error is a little less.
Okay.
And so it's sort of, to me, it's, there's less potential of error with them. How that said, if you know how to set up the knuckle correctly mm-hmm. and you know how to make it the correct torque and you know amount of friction to turn the knuckle,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't loosen up, and you check it, the bearings are probably better in the long run.
Okay, cool, good to know.
So I think it's one of those things. The eliminator is sort of an easier route
mm-hmm.
where the bearing is probably better.
A better route.
Yeah, okay. Better route if you do it correctly into the book.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So what else would you do? What about...
Yeah, let's go out the knuckle a little bit mm-hmm. farther. There's a lot of different options for hubs.
There's a lot of different options for hubs out there, for
and
sure.
In my experience, the Toyota stock Asian hubs...
Mm-hmm.
are the strongest.
I would agree with that. I've seen, you know, Warn has a great history with mm-hmm. building really strong hubs for mm-hmm. Jeeps and Danas and corporate axles. But when it comes to Toyota axles, there's a long history of Warn hubs not working very well with Toyota axles.
I had a Warn hubs on Bobcat when I first bought it,
mm-hmm.
and I broke a hub, and then I just changed to the Asian. And I haven't had an issue yet.
And it's really like nobody, as soon as you put Asians on, nobody ever has an issue with them
mm-hmm.
Until you put a bigger engine in your rig or something.
Or
so.
You're not greasing them right, because sometimes they could get stuck in, sometimes they get stuck out, mm-hmm. sometimes the spring falls off. You know, they do have their finicky times as well, but you don't usually find them like shattering out on the trail.
Yeah.
I'm sure it happens. I'm sure we'll get a listener writing us.
Yeah.
This happened to me. I always carry dry flanges.
I do too. I have some in my toolbox.
If the hub breaks, then I put on a dry flange.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're building a rig to be strictly off-roading and you're never, ever going to take it out of four-wheel drive, just put on dry flanges.
Yeah.
It's a non-mechanical moving part. It's not moving. You're just bolting this part on, and it locks the hubs permanently.
It's like having a spool in your diff.
Yeah.
The same concept there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, the strongest route is dry flanges, and then I think AZ and hubs, and then out. But if you're going to be driving this on the road, then, you know, dry flanges might not be an option for you. But I still carry them. I also have a set of the inner rings on me as well, if those ever work.
Okay.
So.
Nice.
Yeah. And then from there, you know, I think we kind of talked about hydroassist a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I would definitely do hydroassist. And I think you want to talk on that since we just did it on yours.
I love my hydroassist. I keep saying everybody I talk to about it. I wish I did it when I first got the rig. It's hands down, in my opinion, the best performance upgrade I've done to the rig. I would put it up there, you know, right after gearing and lockers. So like, I put gearing and lockers up there almost before suspension and tires, in my opinion.
Yeah, they kind of have to be at the same time.
They kind of, yeah, they all have to be at the same time. But it's like, I put on a suspension. I put on a suspension. I don't know. I really like my gearing and lockers. So, HydroAssist I love even more. And I got to use it on the Father's Day trip, and it was kind of cool just to use on that one little section of the trail where I needed it. But on the Rubicon, you know, I have a lot more opportunity to really test the HydroAssist, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
So
you finally got it up with some good articulation, and somebody's like, "You got to turn driver."
Yep.
And you're like, "Okay." And you
with just the spin locker, your tire. With the lockers on while I'm driving, and it just boop 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 boop. Yeah, palm it over, and it just turned the whole thing. It was great. So, HydroAssist is great. It fixes also any death wobble issues you have too. So if you're trying to run a steering dampener,
it doesn't fix the death wobble.
True, it doesn't fix it. It
hides it.
It hides it. That is true. But yeah, if you're
hinders,
like,
maybe is a better word, hinders the problem.
It hinders the problem for sure. But yeah, it makes the ride smoother. A lot of people say that, especially with Jeeps. I hear a lot of Jeepers say that their HydroAssist is really twitchy. Mm-hmm. I have not found that to be the case at all in any HydroAssist rig that I've ever driven. I've only driven three, but on the road, I should say.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I feel mine has a very slight lag.
I've noticed that. You said it to me to watch out for the lag, and I didn't notice it at first. I've kind of started noticing it. The big thing for me that I've noticed is that it likes to wander on the road.
Mm.
It doesn't just go straight like a normal steering straight up setup would. It kind of likes to wander really, really slowly, though.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the only thing I've noticed, and I've found that it wanders based on the little bit of the road, which way the road is tilted for water drain off.
Yeah.
So it'll just kind of wander, and I'll pull it back, and it'll wander back the other way, wander back the other way. But it's very, very subtle, and I haven't noticed any twitchiness, quote unquote, to it.
Yeah. I know. I notice with my HydroAssist is like when I start to turn, the power steering box is turning, and then the pinion is, you know, turning, and the wheels start to turn. But then it takes like a second for the fluid to get down to the ram.
Oh, yeah.
And then the ram kicks on.
Oh, interesting.
Right? And so like I can feel like, okay, I'm starting to turn. Oh, there's the ram.
Interesting.
And
okay.
So I can file, I call it a delay for the ram, right? So like I'm starting to turn the wheel, then the ram kicks in.
Okay.
So I can feel the difference between those.
Okay.
But maybe I'm just a princess in the pee or something. Yeah. I don't know.
You know your rig too well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's my baby.
So yeah, if you're going to do big tires, especially something like 40s, get a HydroAssist for sure.
And to go with HydroAssist, you really should have a high steer.
I agree 100%. You really want to have that high steer.
High steer and setting up your you know, the ends correctly, whether they're tie rods, you know, or what do you have on yours?
I have Himes or the rough stuff Himes.
Yeah. You know, and then just making the big beefy bars going across there, you know, because the hydro assist puts an immense amount of stress on your steering components.
Yes,
especially when you're like up on a rock and your tires are pinched between rocks and you're trying to turn one way or another, your ram is pushing all those components and it'll do it.
And it will.
It'll either push those components or bend those or break those components.
Yeah. So my dad, I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast. My dad was up for Marlin Crawler Roundup 4 years ago, maybe five.
Okay.
And so he was going down the trail, and I think it was either in Gatekeeper or somewhere near the beginning of the trail. He got bound up, and his hydro assist broke the tie rod off of his steering knuckle and punched the tie rod through his wheel, his rim. So he, Marlin, who my dad is buddies with, got out of his rig. He was either in front or right behind my dad, one or the other, and got out, and they sat there and welded it in the middle of the trail, in the middle of MCR, middle of the roundup, and, welded the tie rod back to the knuckle and then welded up the wheel, the hole in the rim. And then they just went on down the trail and it worked just fine the rest of the trip. And when he got home, he replaced everything, but yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah. So hydro assist doesn't care what's in the way. It's going to push.
It's going to work. If you're pushing the wheel, it's going to push it.
Yeah.
As hard as it can. And then from there, I think just some good shocks, you know, and a good suspension setup. If you're going to go 40s, you're probably going to have to cut some of the body.
I agree.
So take that into account.
You're going to have to use a really big hammer on your firewall and the pinch seam there
for
sure.
Or push your axle really far forward. You know, so there's a lot of other things that go into going into 40s besides just beefing it up for the axle. That we're not really talking about. I mean, we're just talking about today is what's going into this axle.
The front axle in particular,
Yeah, and for the rear axle, I mean, it doesn't turn, it doesn't steer, it just follows along. So a lot of the stresses on the rear axle are, it's much less than what's going on in the front.
Much simpler.
Yeah. The front axle is the weaker of the two just because it has more moving parts. For the rear axle, you just need to, you know, upgraded wheel bearings or upgrade, you know, put some trusses on there, you know, chrome shafts, you know, and some rock protection, you know, possibly bigger brakes on that end too, if you want. And that's really, you know, about all that you need to do on that rear axle.
Yeah. So that's kind of what we've come up with in terms of building a front Toyota axle to handle the stresses of running 40s. Like we said, we don't really recommend it. But in the next year, Jimmy's going to be running 40s on Bobcat. I'll be running probably the 3950 IROX on the 4Runner. And we have pretty much all of these things we've talked about, we've done to our front axles. So it's just a matter of now, will it actually work and how long will it hold up?
Yeah.
I have a feeling the weak point is going to be either the hubs or the ring and pinion.
Or transmission.
Or the transmission is going to go up. Well, not my transmission. I have the R151. It's a it's a beefy thing.
I have the W56 and the 21 spline output shaft. You know, and that could be the weak link of the whole thing.
So we'll see. We'll let you guys know whenever we get around to it. Maybe we'll have a race and see who does it first. But and then we'll see who breaks something first.
All I need are wheels.
I just need the tires. Well, I guess I need my rear suspension redone, but
you're gonna stick with 15 inch rims on 39s?
Why not?
Does somebody sell those? IROC sell those?
They have the 3950 15s.
15?
Yeah, 15 inch rim.
Oh my okay.
Not 15 inch wide. I think they're 1250 wide.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think Pitbull as well has some 39 flavored 15 inch rim tires. So we'll see what I do there. But yeah, like I said, this is kind of what stuff we've done. If you have some ideas on how to build up a front axle or think of something that we forgot, definitely write us in, let us know. Maybe it's something we've never heard of. So if some fun finangled thing that you have ideas of. So
yeah.
I know we have a few listeners out there that come up with some pretty harebrained ideas for stuff. Let us know. You can shoot emails over to Tyler at snailtrail4x4.com or Jimmy at snailtrail4x4.com. You can find us over at Instagram at SnailTrail4x4. You can find, if you have any radio questions or have any follow-up questions about the Baofeng thing or the FCC, not the FCC, the World Radio Communications Conference, you can write those in to me at, you know, that email, or you can find me over at My Off-Road Radio on Instagram. And of course, check out all the videos over on YouTube. We have some fun ones coming out, and I officially got my tire plug video up. So I am now a YouTube star. I'm just putting it out there.
Yes, you are.
Yes. So there's lots of videos up there. Jimmy, you're doing what, 2 to 3 videos a week right now? We're trying to pump out.
I was doing 3 for a while, and now I think I'm backing it down to 2.
Okay.
And just cause I didn't see.
3 is a lot.
3 was a lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, and I wasn't getting the reward out of it that I expected. So yeah. I'm just going to cut back to 2 and try to do more work for the patrons and do some stuff for the podcast, maybe write a blog, things that still need to get done and and not do the time that I was investing in another video.
Totally. So yeah, check out the videos up over at the Snail Trail YouTube channel. And of course, don't forget the monthly giveaway. And if you're interested in it, the goodie boxes that we're doing on the Patreon account, which is patreon.com/snailtrail4x4. So I believe with that, my friends, and Mr. JJ the Hydrojet, do you have any final words for everybody out there?
I love how we write everything down on cardboard.
And with that, my friends, keep crawling.